This episode is sponsored by eBay Authenticity Guarantee. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you know you're getting the real deal. Whether you're looking for a head-turning handbag or a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear that make every step feel fly. These days, to know you're getting the real deal, go straight to eBay. When you're searching, just look for that blue check mark. It will say Authenticity Guarantee. That means when you buy it, you can be confident that it's authenticated by real experts. Listen, when you're finally ready to buy that thing you love, you have to make sure that you're not going to catch a fake. They're everywhere, and it's really tough to tell the difference for yourself. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, that's easy. So again, look for the blue check mark, and that way you know that when it hits your doorstep, not only do you know it's real, but that feeling that you get when you put it on is, well, also for real. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms. Welcome to Identity, a series brought to you by ID Magazine. Join me, Mahari Seward, ID's Senior Fashion Features Editor, as I explore the enduring legacy of some of the last four decades' most influential subcultures and the guiding figures within them. This week, we're speaking to one of the world's most prolific DJs and producers, someone who, on first hearing their name, you may not automatically equate with underground culture, Diplo.
If someone told me there was rules to this, I wouldn't have done it. So anybody young that wants to make music, you know, hopefully they realize there are no rules. We were like really mixing records live. We were like doing weird mixes and cutting acapellas. I play a Cure record and I mix it with like a hip hop beat and I would juggle it. And we were doing these mashups. And that was the beginning of mashup culture. Like as long as you make it great and make it so if you feel something, you get goosebumps when you play it, the whole process was the right way. We brought together parties that were insane. Like we had MIA and Bun B with Stretch Armstrong came from New York and, you know, Mark Ronson would come and play and rock and roll guys come and be like, what is this? It was very much DIY. If you understand culture, you know, you have to have empathy towards everybody's musical heritage or their heritage in general. You know, if you have the power of the history, you know, understand it, you have the power to move forward.
Today, Diplo is best known for his blockbuster productions, working with titanic artists like Beyoncé, G-Dragon, and Madonna, and playing festivals like Coachella. However, on tracing his roots, you soon discover that his creative perspective has always been rooted not just in an appreciation of subculture, but an active participation in it. From growing up in Florida to his holotronics parties in Philadelphia, his pioneering work with MIA to his status as an early international promoter of Brazilian belly funk, while Diplo has played a key role in bringing previously underground sounds to a mainstream audience, it hasn't been without criticism. At times, he's been levelled with accusations of failing to acknowledge the contextual and subcultural importance of the sounds he's embraced in his musical repertoire, and the responsibility he holds in exporting them to the masses. As well as addressing these nuances, Diplo discusses his immersion in Daytona Beach's biker counterculture, meeting MIA, and why he believes subculture still thrives. Here's Diplo. Well, I remember reading somewhere that growing up in Daytona Beach, talking about being involved in the city's counterculture, which I thought was quite interesting, as it isn't necessarily a city that, at least on my radar as a cultural journalist, has cropped up as a particularly thriving heart of counterculture. Yeah. And so I was just wondering if, or A, you could kind of give us a little bit of a picture of what Daytona Beach is like for someone who's never been, and also a bit of an insight into its countercultural scene that you were a part of.
Well, every city has a culture, yeah. No matter where you are. You know, it's crazy. And I learned that growing up. And Daytona is special because it's a very poor city. It's almost like the Detroit of the South. Like it had a really big heyday. The 80s were big for us. There was a lot of drugs in Florida and we had spring break. If you ever watched like MTV, that's where they went. Everybody went there like from the 80s. They would just go to Daytona Beach and party nonstop. The two main things about Daytona is we have a huge beach culture we can drive cars on. And it's a really long beach from the water to where to the street starts. And it's really hard sand. So they used to race cars on the beach in like the 1920s and 30s. And that ended up becoming the beginning of car racing in America. And that's where you hear about the Daytona 500. We have the biggest racetrack in America. And NASCAR is the home in Daytona Beach. So mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys are familiar with NASCAR, but it is like the redneck version of F1. The next big thing about Daytona is we have a huge motorcycle culture. There's Bike Week there. So it's full of biker gangs. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of drugs that are moving up and down the coast. And a lot of, if you go to bike bars, it's probably the sketchiest thing you can do in America is like trying to, you know, not fitting in and going to like biker gang bars. And there's like black bikers, white bikers. It's like a really diverse scene, actually. You wouldn't believe it until you go and see what Bike Week is like. And in fact, my first jobs were parking bikes. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so anyway, that's the culture. That's what the fringes of the Daytona culture are. And then it's also a diverse place. Like I went to like the all black high school because it was the only high school there with computers when I was younger. There's like the beach high school and there was like the hood high school across the river. And that was the one that had like the computers and things like that. Cause I wanted to work in music and I wanted to work in computers. And the beach high school was like the surfers. And if I had gone to that other high school, my life would be totally different. Like I would have been a surfer and I probably would have stayed in Daytona. But because I went to the high school that had like a computer program, I ended up learning a lot more. And we had a really good creative writing program and I had awesome teachers there. And then I moved to the big city, which was Orlando. The big, giant, shiny city. And that's where I moved. And that was actually something cultural. I joined like the hip hop scene there. I was like doing graffiti and I was like working on rap music and helping people make beats. And I went to raves and the parks. And it was a really big city for DJs. You obviously hear about Detroit and Chicago and New York. But when DJs would come from Europe and play those cities, they'd always would add Orlando. Like, because it was a place where they made money and people did love dance music. It wasn't, we didn't like build the culture, but we had a lot of fans there.
And so were you yourself DJing at this point, or were you sort of just more of a participant in this kind of wider rave party culture that was happening there at the time?
I was trying to DJ. I was not like good enough to play those big parties. And those were like DJs. Those DJs were like in their 30s and 40s and, you know, they were older. And it was like a real scene. Back when you were younger, you couldn't just be like a 16-year-old DJ. I'm from a place where there was never like young DJs, you know, like it was like there's guys on the radio and I just kind of happened to fall into it. I wanted to be a DJ and I loved turntablism and I loved producing and I loved hip hop, but I didn't have the equipment and have the money. But I did DJ in Daytona at pools, like really cheap, like DJ for like families and stuff. And I play like whatever records I had. Like I played the Beastie Boys and I played like a Jimi Hendrix record and I played a bass record. I didn't have any like swag or like style of DJing. I just played music for people. And I made a little money on the side, but that was the beginning of me understanding like what DJing is. It's not just about being the coolest DJ. It's about like you have to find a way to make money and like build a little bit of structure around you. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, once I started living in Orlando, I did participate a lot more. There was a place called Supper Club, and I used to DJ there on Sunday nights. They had a night called Fat and Jazzy, and it was like acid jazz and trip hop was the big thing. Like Portishead would come play in Orlando, and I was really excited about those kind of groups, like, you know, Massive Attack and that kind of stuff. It was a party that had that kind of music and it was a good vibe. And that was the beginning of me DJing and a real for audience.
And I gather, was it soon after then that you moved to Philadelphia for uni?
Basically, I thought I had hit a ceiling in Florida. I was like, it's not really much else I can do here. And, you know, I'd packed up all the things that I loved about Florida, like the bass music, dance hall, you know, of course, metal, because metal was a huge thing in Florida too. Hardcore metal was big. So then I packed all that stuff up that I loved and I moved to Philly, and it was like a really big turn for me because it's a rough place. It's a lot harder. The music scene was much different. And I think I brought what I loved about Florida up there and I started some events. And that was like the key to my success was like building these small parties in Philly over 4 or 5 years. It took a long time. I didn't start DJing properly like as a job till I was like 23.
And these are the Holotronics parties that you're
exactly
talking about.
Called Holotronics, and
totally. And how did that come about? I mean, what was the sort of impetus for it?
I think growing up in Florida, like I was trying to express that Florida had this diversity that nobody like really talked about. Like everybody kind of hung out together, and I grew up like feeling that. And then when I got to Philly, I realized like, oh damn, there is segregation everywhere. Like, you know, like I would play like the black clubs or the white clubs at the time, actually. The black clubs were having house music when I first started going there. It was like more like Victor Duplay and like Rich Medina. And then the white clubs were having more like hip hop, like Puff Daddy and pop. And there was like a middle club that was like rich people that didn't even know what they were doing, but you didn't really mix it up. But I was going to school there, university, and there was a bunch of kids like me that were like art kids that I felt like were this new thing. We're like, kind of like, we're just like into art and we dress kind of weird. And we're like, kind of like on the internet. Like we have like, we're on message boards and we're like experimenting with music. So I was like, there was something to be done there. Like, there was like a party that was combining people. That's what this party was. It was like the art school kids. And I think it was like, the term hipster, you know, didn't exist yet, but we were those people. Those are the kids that became the Holotronics kids. And we had a message board called the Holotronics board. And it became a big board, even internationally, with people who traded their demos and traded their mixtapes. And I would rent this big venue, like a VFW hall, which is, you know, in America, that's sort of like a public venue that's built by veterans, or in this case, it was Ukrainian immigrants. So they had a Ukrainian immigrant hall, and there's a lot of Ukrainian immigrants in North Philadelphia. And I would just go there and pay them cash and be like, hey, can I rent this place? They had no idea what I was doing. And I'd bring speakers and I'd buy kegs, and it would be like an insane rave. And they were like, what? They were almost canceled every time. They were like, you know what? This is the first time we're making money. So it became a partnership between me and the Ukrainian Association of Philadelphia. And they were like, yeah, we can't wait for you to do the party again. So I started doing this monthly party.
Okay.
Renting the place out and, you know, turning a profit. And I quit my job. And I realized from that moment on, I was going to be able to make it with music somehow. You know, I found the will to survive in a music scene. That was the beginning of my career as a producer and a DJ. Because I thought the next step is to actually release these songs that I'm kind of making. In the demos I'm doing, and that turned into my record label, Mad Decent, which started in Philadelphia. Yeah.
And I'd love to come back onto Mad Decent in greater depth, given that it's an important chapter in your sort of trajectory. But just speaking about Holotronics, could you tell us a little bit about what the sort of, I mean, how would you describe the sound of it? Was it catering to a particular audience? I know that you mentioned sort of art school kids and these sort of proto-hipsters in a way, but was there a particular sort of sound niche that you were trying to bring, or...?
There was two main things. I think Southern hip hop had started to bubble in Atlanta and like Memphis and Nashville. And at the time it was still DMX. It was Jay-Z. It was New York hip hop. It was like the sound of the Northeast. But I had come from Florida and I was listening to Trick Daddy and 2 Live Crew. And I was listening to all this more booty shaking music. And I was thinking people could fuck with this in Philly. So the beginning was me making edits of these sort of Southern records, Little John, and putting big records from kind of the indie dance scene. Cause at the time there was a third scene. There was like the white kids, the black kids, and there was kind of like the indie rock kids. Mm-hmm. Cause there was a real rock scene. And the indie rock kids listened to like New Order and party at this place called Transit. And there's a big party called Making Time that my friend Dave Pianca, who's still a big DJ, started. And he had this other scene that was more the rock and roll kids. Kids had like mullets, they wore bell bottoms, they went to disco, and like they danced to like techno and the DFA stuff at the time, you know, like Soul Wax, that kind of vibe. Mm-hmm. So I incorporated that kind of sound, the Soul Wax sound, with hip hop from the South, like David Banner, Little John, and 3-6 Mafia. And we would play these records that go between house and hip hop the whole time. And these edits that would like a big edit I played was Eurythmic Sweet Dreams with a big rap record on top of it. And we were doing these mashups, and that was the beginning of mashup culture too. And then we were going head to head with guys like Too Many DJs. They would actually play our venue. They were the only other DJs to play our venue. And we were really mad because they had a bigger crowd than us. And they're also much more famous, but that made me even strive to do it bigger and be better. And we brought together parties that were insane. Like we had MIA and Bun B from, you know, UGK play with Stretch Armstrong, came from New York. And, you know, Mark Ronson would come and play. And, you know, Petey Crack, the local rappers from Philly, would play. And they would like, be the first time to play for like these kind of like college kids, these white kids. And then you'd have like rock and roll guys come and be like, what is this? It was very much DIY. And yeah, the sound was like that. And I would introduce weird things I find on the internet. I think, you know, Brazilian music was really big for me at the time because I was finding these funk karaoke, Baile Funk records that would sample the Smiths or Madonna.
Right.
Have like a sample and then just have like chaotic Portuguese screaming on top, and I'd play a few of these edits I made and people loved them because it was like Miami bass with some 80s samples with big drums, and those were kind of like the peak records. Anything Missy Elliott too was really big, you know, because she was the first one to really hybridize dance music and hip-hop in a really cool way. She Wants to Move by NERD was a big record for us because it mixed like, you know, rock and roll and house music and hip-hop, and anything like that was big for us.
And I mean, towards the end of the Holotronics years, like it grown to quite a scale and it was touring, no?
Yeah, we started to play shows because the Fader magazine had booked us once to go to New York. And when we came to New York, we just like crushed it. Like nobody was DJing like what we were doing in New York City. So people were like, we were like really mixing records live. We were like doing weird mixes and cutting acapellas. I play a Cure record and I mix it with like a hip hop beat and I would juggle it. And me and my other partner, DJ Low Budget, who was like, you know, a key part of the story, me and him, we were like competitive and we were trying to be the best DJs in the city. That's what you do when we live in Philly, you're a DJ. Like the DJ culture there is so strong, starting with Jazzy Jeff, Cash Money, like I said, Rich Medina, Cosmo Baker. There's so many big DJs from there. Like we're like the place that says we're like the home of the hip hop DJ. So we had to be very good. And the main part of the culture was we had mixtapes. We would sell them at our shows. And I would start to sell them online and I'd sell them to distributors. And we made a lot of money with hard copy mixtapes back then. And as we started playing New York, people were like, oh, I want to book you for San Francisco. Oh, I want to book you for, you know, Switzerland. I want to book you for Australia. So I was starting to tour like the world. I had to get a passport.
Mm-hmm. And was it after Holotronics that Mad Decent, that you founded the record label, or did those sort of intersect?
They completely intersected because as I started making the mixtapes, I'd go up to New York and I would go to this warehouse and they would print my mixtapes for me. And they also were like, we do vinyl too. So I was like, okay, I'll release a couple pieces of vinyl and I would, you know, make like 100 of like my edits. And the bootleg market back then was actually very lucrative. Like there was a brand called Killa Cuts, AVH Records, which was like Armin Van Helden did like these bootlegs and stuff like that. And you would take them, you'd just bring these records to the record stores in Philly, like Second Street Records, Records on South Street, all these different record shops. I would sell 10 to each shop for like $6 a piece. And after, you know, a day, I'd make like a couple $100. And I would just drive around my car with like bags of records and bags of mixtapes and go sell these shops. And that was the beginning of the label. Because some of the songs is like, oh, damn, we actually got a, this is a new music we're making now. Like I had a Black Star who was from Baltimore, who, you know, also Baltimore Club was a huge part of our music. Like Philly Club didn't really exist yet. Like that's what you hear when you hear something like Lil Uzi Vert's I Just Want to Rock. That's called Philly Club, 150 BPM. Back then it was only Baltimore Club and it was 128 BPM. And it was the same Think Break from Lynn Collins, James Brown record. And you could play a whole night of just this one pattern of a loop in a kick drum with vocals on top. So I started releasing some of these records and they were really big on the radio and really big in the clubs. And Black Star was our first artist and he had a record called Shake It to the Ground. That was our first like real release with Rai Rai. And we shot a video down in Baltimore and we put it on YouTube and it was our first video that hit like 1 million views. And we were like, okay, we have a label now.
Because one thing with Mad Decent that I think it's become known for, especially in retrospect, is of course how it became a portal for kind of your interest in music and music cultures in a global context as well. I think you mentioned Funk Carioca and like Baile Funk and like the way that kind of, I guess, Mad Decent served as a point of introduction for many people to those genres and those sort of musical cultures. Was that always something that you wanted to do with the record label?
Yeah, 100%. I was really inspired by... We were obviously a dance label, but I was inspired by labels like Folkways and record labels that archived music, you know, back in the post-World War I America, when you recorded the early blues records, you recorded like Zydeco records, you know, archiving music and preserving culture was something I was really fascinated by. And I'm glad that, you know, America has such a good library of our culture, our music. And I thought what I was doing was similar. Like we were like, all these club records from Philadelphia, Baltimore, even stuff I was like recording in Brazil, I'm like, but this stuff needs to get released, you know, like this stuff's just like exists on the radio, let's like put this out, let's like sign these records and actually have them in a catalog. It wasn't really like a money making, the record label didn't make as much money as the parties and the mixtapes, but it was a beginning. And I think people did learn a lot about Baltimore Club. I think the first big record after that was Little John, did like Shots and stuff like that. Then the records became more on the radio. But we put out those records like 6-7 years earlier. And they were just small. They were in our little market. But as we started traveling, we would play these records and like you'd have Baltimore Club in Australia. Cashmere Cat was in Norway. And we started playing, we had a show there. And I mean, like all these guys were starting to make it in Europe, but their own style, like faster with like little vocal samples. And I love the fact that we were putting these records out. Every kid in the world started doing their version of these sounds because Baltimore Club felt like it was made with just a few loops. You didn't even need to have like the knowledge of like sampling or whatever you want. You just like something. You put it in Cool Edit Pro, whatever the program was at the time, Acid. You put a kick and you could put another a phrase you want. And that was all you needed. You needed three tracks on the record and that's it. And you had a banger. And I think it empowered a lot of kids. You know, I think in London you had like a lot of kids are making grime with just their PS2 at the time because they had a beat making program. So that gave the kids the access point to make it very cheaply because everybody had a PS2, right? So it's the same thing that culture grew crazy with the kids that were like 14, 15. I think the same thing happened with... Baltimore club with like a little bit of older kids because it was so accessible and it was easy to make.
This episode is sponsored by eBay Authenticity Guarantee. Maybe you're looking for a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear that make every step feel fly. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can be confident that real experts are making sure every inch, stitch, and logo is authentic. So next time, just look for that blue check mark that says Authenticity Guarantee. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms. As it kind of grew, was there a particular point where you became aware that the audiences that you were playing to and kind of catering to were no longer uniquely underground or subcultural?
I think the first thing was doing Fabric.
Yeah.
You know, for me, that was like a mainstream club. I mean, it was a pretty underground club, but I was like a club people paid tickets to go see. Like everything else I did was cash. You come and drive, you get a wristband. You know, I didn't sell tickets to shows. You just came to my show. And Fabric was like, this is like a place for people headline. Mm-hmm. So I played there and I really they liked what I did because I did something weird. Like I was doing the mashup culture, but with more leaning more urban. Like it wasn't just like Dolly Parton over like a rock record or something. It was like, we were kind of like, I was into like grime at the time. So I was playing like, I produced a Kano record and I was kind of mixing what I liked about that world. So there's a party called Run the Road. That was like the grime party of Fabric. And I started playing there, but I was like the American guy that would mix it with hip hop. And so I was making these edits that like, I'd go from like Usher, into like a drill beat or something back then. And like, I would do these things and I'd put acapella on top of it. So everywhere I went, I catered to the crowd a little bit. Like I knew like, oh, I'm gonna play London. They have a culture here. I'm gonna fuck with it and make it crazy. Cause they're not gonna like my music unless I tease them a little bit of what they're doing too, you know? Like I have to bring them in to show them something new. Mm-hmm. And then I released a mixtape with them with Fabric. It was like probably the most chaotic fucking Fabric mixtape. It was like, they told me it was not possible. I couldn't clear the records, but I tried everything. I got like The Cure on there. I got Outkast mixed, you know, mashing these records up. They didn't even have people doing mashups back then on the Fabric mixtapes, but I was like doing all these edits and making it really special. I was like, I want to make something like last, like people understand like what we were doing in Philly. And I think that was the beginning of it. Like it became something else after that, you know? And once my mashups became like the Diplo thing, whatever, they became like new productions. And then I started using like the Brazilian funk drums on other records that were like, you know, I did a Vibes Cartel record at the time with a bass beat. And I, you know, tracked him in Philly. And, you know, those records weren't big, but they were like weird. They were like, so you had to like have a strange idea to put those together. And then that became something new, you know? And I think that was the beginning of like the mainstream style, because then that's when MIA heard about me. And, you know, I think that's when Richard Russell from the XL Recordings had heard about me, and his A&Rs were like reaching out to me, and then they were like, let's make something for real. Mm-hmm. The beginning of my relationship with MIA, we made the mixtape, Piracy Funds Terrorism, and that was like the beginning of me being a producer, I guess.
Speaking of MIA, there was something I wanted to ask you about this, because in my research, I read that there was a sort of an ID magazine connection in that sort of like meeting story.
I think there was some connection between her and ID magazine. I mean, this MIA went to Central St. Martin's, right?
Exactly. I mean, like, you know, London in the early noughties.
General path is to like, your goal is to like go to ID magazine is like the ultimate place to be recognized if you go to like that area for school. So that was her, like, I think, I'm not sure the connection exactly, but I learned about all that then, you know, like she brought me to like my first carnival in London. Mm-hmm. Like I learned, I was like, damn, this is like really special. This is crazy. So yeah, Maya was like, for sure had some, she was a hustler too. So she had all kinds of things like going on, like on the clubs and the music. For sure there was something there. Maybe I might've done some ID magazine parties back then too.
Just coming back to what we were discussing before. Yes, obviously we're talking about MIA and then Paper Planes, and that really sort of catalyzed your global ascent and repute in many senses. And the next big thing that people kind of came to know you for after them was Major Lazer, of course, which is a project that I think many people will say, again, played a pretty key role in sort of like introducing people to, you know, sounds and sort of rhythms that they hadn't necessarily been exposed to before. But I was also wondering, with respect to something like Major Lazer, were you ever kind of conscious of a certain responsibility in bringing certain sounds or music cultures into this more mainstream context? Or was it just something that kind of was more of an authentic expression of what you were interested in at the time and how you wanted to present that?
I think with Jamaican music in general, it's just a money-driven culture. Like, when you go down there, by the time I was going to Jamaica to work, there was already, like, Italians down there, Germans. The Japanese were the biggest sound systems in Jamaica at the time. Like, it was like Mighty Crown was, like, running Jamaica at the time. So dancehall culture was, like, so global. And the Jamaicans knew that. Like, they were like, okay, if we want to make money, we got to go tour Japan. We got to go tour Germany. Like, they were, like, in England doing carnival shows. So I was, like, down in Jamaica just in the trenches, like, working on music because I was excited about the producers. We started Major Lazer. I didn't think even we were going to release records. I was just like, I want to learn from, like, these producers. I want to, like, see what's going on. I'm excited about the vocal sounds. I'm excited about what these people are doing. There's something new because at the time in dance hall, Timbaland had just put out Past That Dutch, and that was, like, a kind of a ripoff of a big of Diwali rhythm, right? And Diwali rhythm was, like, a ripoff of, like, an Indian rhythm. And I was like, all this stuff for me was, like, the end of culture. Like, everything was coming together, and it was a mashup. It was like all this kind of chaotic. That was what drove me to Jamaica, because they were just doing whatever the fuck they wanted. It was like so crazy. It wasn't even dance hall at that point. Like, they were doing all kind. It was just changing. Because, you know, if I had gotten there like in the early 2000s or like, you know, 90s, I would have been more into like dance hall culture, like proper like Dembo and, you know, Cuddy Ranks. I was too young for that. I was like there when Sean Paul and Elephant Man, and at that time they were making something brand new. It was very much like a bastardized version of dancehall. And I feel like I was part of that culture. Like, it was like this post Pharrell, post Timberland version of dancehall. And those guys were the trendsetters because they were like, they didn't have to answer anybody. They really made records just for the clubs. And I think England led the way with Carnival, and England led the way with like people picking these dancehall records that were big in the club. So for me, I never really thought till like later, I was like, oh, I guess I'm like the white guy. Because it was like, kind of like I said, it was international at the time. People were doing everywhere. And I grew up with dancehall, so it wasn't like unique, and I was treated like anybody else down there. You know, as long as you had cash to pay for the dub plates, you're just part of the business. It was just business. No one there was like protecting the culture. They're like, let's go make money. In retrospect, I think it was very special that like me and MIA and like Santi Gold and you know, Switch, who was a big producer who helped me with Major Lazer the first couple albums, who I met through Fabric. An English guy, a Sri Lankan girl, you know, girl from Philly. And then, you know, all my dancehall plugs back then was like Left Side, and Vibes Cartel was like a really big, you know, he took me under his wing. He like recorded with me a lot. I just thought it was like, we just were like a whole team. Like, it was like, we were just doing something really weird. And that's kind of the advent of Major Lazer, because we were making music together. In the end, I think dancehall is so special because it is made up of a million things, you know? If you like look at the roots of Jamaican music, it comes from, you know, soul radio, from the military bases turning into rocksteady, and, you know, from mento into ska into reggae. And then you have like the path that Bob Marley went to. And then you have the path that dancehall went to. And it went back to Latin, you know, went to Panama, came back to Puerto Rico, and went back to Jamaica, went to England, and then it went to Trinidad, and then went back to, it's like this conversation, like the story never ends. And I just feel like I'm part of that story, you know?
Totally. I guess it sounds like the way you're describing it. And I think many would agree. It's sort of like a relic of this sort of, you know, unending game of, well, not game of, but unending pattern of cultural exchange.
And hopefully, you know, dancehall kind of hit like a, because of African music, it kind of hit a little of a wall. And I hope that, I was down there playing Jamaica in January, and we were playing like a new thing we were doing. Because it kind of hit a patch where like African music got so big and took up all the bandwidth for that kind of culture, that Jamaican music's kind of like not having like a lot of vibes right now. But I feel like there's all these young guys who are like actually more exciting than ever. So we were trying to go down there. I'm like I said, it is a conversation that kind of keeps happening. Like the music, it's like it doesn't start or begin with me or anybody involved. It's just like we're just all part of it. Culture is like one long line, you know?
Totally. I mean, you did mention that it was sort of like later down the line, there was perhaps a sense of like, oh, like this is how this is being perceived. And, you know, terms like appropriation get thrown about. And that is a conversation that I think has developed in a very interesting way when you think about it in terms of maybe like a sine wave, I guess. In the sense that I think where we are even now compared to where we were 3 years ago is a very different place in terms of where that line is drawn, in part because of, say, like the internet and the way that people engage with culture in this kind of hyper-accelerated like form of exchange. But I was just curious to hear from you, like if that was something that, hearing those criticisms, that was something that you took on board, and if it affected the way that you approached your work as a producer, as a DJ, as a cultural diffuser, and you know, touch point for people around the world?
Not really. I was always just living my life. You know, I came from Florida. You know, for me, making music is just music. If music affects you, if you feel something, that's the only connection you should have with it. You know, like it's like as a human being, we all have responsibilities and we have to educate ourselves. Like, you know, if you understand culture, you understand what it's like to be a young white guy from the South, or like what it's like to be like a gay black kid that lives in Germany. Like everybody has a reason to be there. And like, what's the ramifications? Like, how do they end up there? Like, how are they perceived? And, you know, you have to have empathy towards everybody's musical heritage or their heritage in general. And if you have that, you know, if you have the power of the history, you understand it, you have the power to move forward. And, you know, I can speak about it in like a cultural anthropology way, you know, different podcasts. But for me, I always felt like, I said to you before, I'm just adding, you know, a little bit of what I can to things, you know, whether it's like fabric, you know, and I played there and I added a little bit of flavor, and hopefully I inspired someone to do something after me. You know, if I go to Jamaica, hopefully I inspired like the young guys to do something after me, because I was inspired by all those producers, like I told you when I was going there. Or I was in country music, you know, hope I inspire like kids to mix hip hop and country music together. I mean, honestly, country music is probably the most place where I've had the most anger at like cultural appropriation, you know, like that's
really
one place where like you have to, you can't just like be a tourist there like that. Like in Jamaica, you kind of could, because everybody's like happy because they're like, oh, we're going to like make money when you guys come here and make music with us. Country music is like, you have to live the life. Like you have to be part of the country radio. You have to go to Nashville. Like you can't just drop a record and bounce, you know, like kind of like, that's a controversy about Beyonce being part of it, you know?
Well, I was going to say, that's very topical, isn't it?
It's the exact same thing. And I think for me, it was always like, I always had pushback there. And it's hard to work with artists because, you know, I was too urban.
You've previously self-described as a punk or someone who embodies a sort of punk spirit. Do you think that still holds true today?
Yeah, I think that's what I love about hip hop. As growing up, that was like my first love, was I love the idea of, you know, these guys, Bambaataa and even Malcolm McLaren and Kool Herc, and you know, later on like guys like Q-Tip, and they were just creating these sounds with like old records and old vibes and old culture, and then adding something new. And you know, it was chaotic. The most postmodern music is the way hip-hop is created, you know. And I think even Memphis hip-hop, for me, that's probably the most important hip-hop culture, was like Memphis hip-hop for me. When I lived in Nashville, like artists like 3 6 Mafia, now you have like the funk scene, but 3 6 Mafia and Hypnotized Minds, that music was just like so dark and crazy, and it spoke to me in such a way that was like so punk. And it sampled, you know, Halloween soundtracks, and then had these like drums, and it was, all songs were about killing everybody, and like, you know, it was just so crazy. And now in 2024, that genre feels like, as a music kind of historian, that genre ends up having the most influence on young people. The Memphis hip hop, the way it traveled through and like went through like A$AP Rocky, and then went through the South, and then went through like the Atlanta scene, and then went, people in Germany and people in Russia and people in Argentina were influenced by this weird little culture. And that music now is really like, has such a presence in what I'm doing. It's such weird to see like that path. I never saw it coming, and it's like all the way back around again. Yeah, I definitely think like all these young people making music with all these influences that they don't kind of like understand, it is actually something unique too, and something beautiful, you know, like
totally.
It is like, having no rules is also important. If someone told me there was rules to this, I wouldn't have done it. Like, I wouldn't have been like, oh, you can't go to Jamaica, or you can't use those kind of drums, or you can't mix these kind of music with people. If I had known those rules, I would have never done anything. And thank God that no one told me those rules till like later, and I'd already kind of made it. So anybody young that wants to make music, you know, hopefully they realize there are no rules. There's no set boundaries to what you can do. You can do whatever you want. You can mix the craziest ideas you ever thought of and try to make it great. Like, as long as you make it great and make it so if you feel something, you get goosebumps when you play it, then the whole process was the right way. You know, the pathway was the right way to do it.
Well, I think the allegory that you just sort of gave about Memphis hip hop and its global diffusion brings me quite nicely onto something that I'd be really interested to hear from you about, which is this notion of the globalization of subculture, and that, you know, through the internet and through like this accelerated form of information exchange, that, you know, subcultures that used to be very geographically specific and very about like a certain community and a scene, that essentially this sort of global dispersion of subculture has led to its ultimate demise. I mean, do you think that it's possible for subcultures to exist in that sort of, I guess, traditional sense anymore?
Yeah. I was a little worried, you know, at the advent of YouTube and how culture kind of came homogenous when everybody kind of had the same access points and they had the same information was given all around the world. But in fact, it just sort of elevated where you go. You know, everywhere you go, you can't take, like, if you're going to Brazil, and Brazil has, you know, maybe 50 distinct cities and cultures that are, you could just really separate each other from each other. But you can never take the people, the culture that forms those people, and no matter how much we feed them American pop music or sports, or whatever, they're going to find a way to, like, make their heart, you know, come out of that. And you can feel who they are and the person they are and the culture that they are. And I really see that, like, when you go to South Africa or somewhere where you have such a brash mashup of people, you know, you have the European influence, like 4 different subcultures in South Africa, tribal languages, Malaysian people, you know, Indian influences. Like, you have all these things, and you have the little bits of information, like house music coming from England, and they transform it into something like Kwaito that becomes I'm a Piano. And you just see, like, the path that little bits of information come down, and it transfers through the people and becomes something brand new and crazy. So watching, like, music travel or somewhere like South Africa or Brazil, and then America, there's so many examples of it. I feel like it's, if anything else, the internet just empowers people to have more access. And when you find something you love, you're going to dedicate yourself to that, you know, if you do love it. And when you dedicate yourself to it and you want to create something, you're going to make something brand new out of it. I did worry that music was going to be homogenous at one point because of how we have one global new service or whatever, but it really is different because people are so much more resilient than that. They have so much more to offer. They're not that easy to be contained into, like, a puddle of information. At least young people are, because young people always want to be better than their older brother. The younger you get, the more crazy. Like, my kids are in a punk band right now, and they're on the internet. They don't have no TikTok. They're, like, anti-TikTok. They just want to be connected with their band, you know, and they meet other bands. Like, I went to their show last night. My son's, like, 13. They're all there with other bands, and they're talking about their bands, and they don't even have, their music's not even on the internet yet. They're just making songs and writing songs. And that's so much different than the kids I meet that are just, all they care about is promoting themselves on Instagram all day long. And, you know, and then my generation, which is, like, kind of like the boomers that are still we're trying to make TikToks that are relevant without being cringy. And then my parents are still on Facebook, you know, like, we have, like, all these different touch tones of, like, what the technology allows us to do. And my kids are kind of anti-technology in a really cool way. So every generation is surprising you, you know, and they always do that. So I think there's, like, hope for sure for every young culture to, like, exist and be fruitful and be chaotic and special.
I mean, do you think that's at all facilitated by a more general mainstream appetite for underground culture and music? I mean, I'm thinking of the fact that, like, I don't know, Lady Gaga for her remix album enlisted, like, LSDXOXO and, like, Shy Girl, who back then would have been considered pretty underground artists, but, you know, they're endorsed by one of the biggest, you know, pop musicians in the world, which I guess speaks to that general acceptance of what would have been considered underground maybe, you know, 10, 15 years back.
I'm not sure if it's Lady Gaga doing that or if it's, like, an A&R, but I mean, anybody, it's important for her to say, like, oh, Lady Gaga is still knows who Shy Girl is. Cause, like, that's important for her to, like, collab. You know, I think Shy Girl, I don't know what I love her so much. Cause, like, to do Bjork, to do she had, like, the craziest array of collaborations and music this year. And honestly, I thought when I was going to meet her, I was kind of scared of her. Cause I was like, damn, this girl's way too cool. She's going to, like, hate me or whatever. And then I met her, and she's actually, like, the coolest person and, like, the most friendly.
She's fab.
It's like, I was like, damn, that gave me even more hope that, like, not everybody's cooler than me and they're going to hate me for being, like, the old white guy that did all this, like, dance hall music, whatever. And I'm like, okay, young people kind of do, they, like, talk to me and learn about what I do. They, like, they love that I love music. And I love that when I met Shy Girl, I was like, damn, she's, like, just like me, loves music and wants to make an impact as crazy as possible, like, go as left as possible and push the boundaries as far as possible. And that's what young people want to do. That's their job. Their job is to be like, fucking, how much further can I fuck this up? Like, that was David Bowie's first fucking thing to say. You know, like, that was The Clash's first thing to do. Like, everybody wanted to fuck it up more. By the time The Clash came out, there was beef in the punk scene. Like, everybody hated them. Like, there was, like, it's like 1979, and the punk scene's already, like, it's already over. Everybody's, like, hate each other because there's too much mainstream shit going on. There's too much this and that. And I love that you burn it down and you make something brand new. You know, I love that everything you do, every culture that comes up, you have to kind of, like, thoughtfully say, okay, fuck the old people. Let's do something brand new and let's do it better than they've ever seen it before and tastefully. And I do think there's hope because a lot of people do love the art. Like, you know, when I listen to, like, Nia Archives or something, I'm like, damn, she's actually doing, like, sick drum and bass. Like, there's actually, like, she knows the history, the sounds that really work, and also doing things that touch a little pop and then touch a little underground. I think it is important. And just, you know, as a music fan, I can tell when people have that love. I can tell when they have that love for what they do and they want to push it. It's always good to like have a hit, you know, because you have to think about that. Like, how are you going to keep paying your bills, but also go as far as you can? And I think, you know, I see A&Rs, like when I hear pop acts drop records, I'm like, they want to like do something weird, but they don't understand it. You know, they want to do something weird so bad and they don't really get it, but they want it. They need to be relevant. And I hear people do it and they like, they nail it, you know? Or even Beyonce, like the last album, like I wasn't really into like her last album, but she really fucking pushed the boundaries. Not the country album.
Renaissance.
Like I was like, she fucking enlisted every
crazy
person. And like, it was like, actually like a song like Pure Honey. Like she actually did things like they sound 100% Beyonce and 100% from that culture. And that's really hard to do. And then some other people, they try to do that. And you could tell like, that's like a bunch of A&Rs with like their calculators putting it together and they don't really get, they don't love it, you know? They don't love the culture.
And just my final question, because I'm conscious of the time restraint that we have. But first off, how would you define subculture?
Anything that you can make your own, you can be a subculture of one person. Anything that you can rewrite and make your own is a subculture.
And what was your introduction to subculture?
I think probably going to like buy cigarettes with my dad at the Indian Reservation when I was like 6 years old. I loved going to there and just seeing all the rednecks and all like the bikers and stuff and listening to country music, driving to Everglades in the morning.
Fantastic. And last one, which I'm eager to hear from you actually, is your most memorable night out and why?
Damn. Probably Major Lazer playing Havana, Cuba. It was just so stressful and crazy. We were the first, you know, American act to ever play in Cuba since the 40s and still the only one. And we played for like 2 million people. Just the fact that we could do that and not even speak the language and play for these kids, and like these kids just got whatever crumbs of information about our project, Major Lazer at the time. And they still loved us and showed us so much gratitude. It was like, just felt like the most peak moment for me was doing that concert.
Fantastic. That's it from me. Thank you so much, Diplo. It was a pleasure to have a chat with you.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks again to Diplo for sharing his stories with us this week. And to the team who were instrumental in bringing Identity to life. Researcher Ailey Duffy, producer Amelia Phillips, and audio production team Robin Lieburn and Simon Williams at Podmasters. Oh, and thanks to you for listening. Join us next week when I'll be speaking to otherworldly style icons and Rick Owens' muses, Fecal Matter.